seen enough of him to know why he's not in the league, but I feel like he's got enough game to be in the league, at least offensively.
He's also got like a really intense work ethic too. Like
Mac McClung
really works hard.
You're not telling me that you think Mac McClung has an intense work ethic just because he's a short white guy who can dunk a basketball?
No. But I've interviewed this guy before, and I'm just saying.
Okay, all right. Welcome to Debatable. A good start to a day when we have tremendous discussion points. June stepped in it before we even got to the show. That's June Lee down there. Izzy Gutierrez is over here. Oh. I'm wearing a City Sports shirt because I'm old enough to have attended a City Sports in my hometown of D.C. It started in Boston, though, June, where you're from. Tell me a City Sports story.
City Sports was in Boston on Comm Ave by Boston University. My dad was getting his PhD there when we moved here, and I bought my first baseball glove there. It was a Mizuno Tom Glavin model. And it was the place that like I went to every single time I needed this piece of sports equipment. Then it closed in the last 5 years, and now it's still kind of an abandoned retail storefront that no one has occupied.
So Izzy, the cool part about City Sports is that they would sell different shirts in like the hometown colors. Now this one is from DC and it's baby blue, and I remember this is the reason I bought it, is because it was so far away from all the other colors. I was like, I have to have this. This represents nothing in DC, but we'll get to that later. Anyway. Welcome to the show. It's Wednesday, Alabaster. What do we got? I think that there's something in the news. I believe the news fairy might have actually come by and paid us.
Are we not talking about Mac McClung for the first segment?
We will start with Brian Flores, but before we get into this discussion, can we all tweet out the show link?
See, so I was looking at
this. Look, you got me this
look
time.
My drafts. You got me. I had it set up. I had it set up.
I'm in a room in the Seaport that has like the worst signal in the world.
Oh, the signal at Seaport is terrible. This is very inside baseball. But once you get into that building at Seaport, it's almost impossible to get anything on your phone if you're not like all into the network. That's another story. While we wait for our unprepared panelists, I'll regale you all. Oh, there we go.
That's, now I feel like I'm
all right,
wasting
I'm
time.
Good. I retweet.
Little hold music.
All right.
This is what I listen to when I make soup. I bought an Instant Pot last night and made some soup. Anyway.
Fantastic. All right, guys, let's get rolling. And our first topic is, what are your thoughts on Brian Flores' lawsuit and the NFL's reaction to it?
Izzy, you're in Miami. We'll go to you first.
Well, I kind of want to make sure that we talk about this really in the right order, sort of like a funnel and sort of the more important stuff at the top, right? Because to me, what I think Brian Flores has decided in a very short period of time is quite the move. It's quite bold, and it's honorable, frankly, because he goes from being a guy who worked his entire life, as he calls it, saying he has a gift for football coaching. I think it's a very specific gift, but okay, he has a gift for football coaching and has decided that I am now going to take on a racist sort of organization or racist process. And it might affect my entire career. It might sort of throw away everything that I've worked my whole life for. And I'm going to be this symbol instead because it's more important. Now, I personally tend to believe that he's going to get another job eventually, that this is not going to end his career. But deciding that in just a matter of days, like that you are now going to be that representative for something that we all know has been there, but nobody has taken this strong of a move. Like, just that decision itself is something that he should be, you know, not just patted on the back for, but he should be lauded for. He should be talked about for a long time, because that's not an easy for anybody who's just been trying to get their job done or trying to do something and not have to represent an entire group of people. They just want to do you, and you decide, no, I've got to do this for everybody else. Like, that is a bold move, and I commend him for it.
June, Flores was in New England for a while, and Belichick is obviously a part of this story. You're a Boston guy. What did you think about it when you first heard the news drop, the lawsuit?
I think the thing that initially struck me the most was the level of confidence and just the willingness to put yourself out there, because when you put yourself out there with this kind of lawsuit and the allegations that he's making the calculation that no, the NFL is potentially going to throw the book at him from a PR standpoint. They're going to try to find every single thing that they can to muddy his reputation in the eyes of the public. And that's already been happening with him post-Dolphins firing as well, where he's willing to be the symbol for all of this stuff and potentially have a landmark lawsuit that, at the minimum, starts a conversation that is incredibly difficult to have in kind of the micro when you're talking about job to job, because any team can have the plausible deniability of, you know, we looked at all the candidates, but there's, you know, we found that this white dude is the guy that we actually want to have. You know, it's easy to kind of brush that off, but when you have such concrete evidence through Bill Belichick's text messages that something fishy might be happening, and to make that decision so quickly is really just something that I think is something that is hard to encapsulate given how many people's trauma that he's taken on. And I think on top of that, it's also illustrative of the fact of how the Rooney Rule undermines the confidence, and a lot of rules like the Rooney Rule, which is not just unique to football, but I think it happens across industries in America, undermines the confidence of minorities when they are in these highly prestigious places of platforms like, you know, coaching football or managing a baseball team or, you know, being an executive for a sports team in general, because you constantly question whether or not you're in the room for the right reasons. And that clouds every single interaction that you have with any person. Like, am I here because of my skill set? Am I here to fill a quota? And that's not just true in the interview process, but I think kind of tints the way that you approach your job in general. And when you have that, it automatically creates a process, a domino effect, where that affects how you approach your job, and you're on this leash where a guy like Mike Tomlin has to be perfect in order to maintain his job as a football coach, and is now, you know, one of the only black football coaches in the sport. And I think there's an element of Flores is kind of illustrating everything that is required and the burden that is required to take on to be a minority at a very, very high level in the sports world specifically.
Okay, so there's a couple things
let's
here.
Let's go over the actual allegation here.
Let's do that. And this is what I was going to say in terms of how I initially approached this from an analysis standpoint, just thinking about what happened. Number one is that he alleges that Stephen Ross approached him to tank games by paying him $100,000 per loss, offering to pay him, excuse me. Now, the second allegation is not related to the Dolphins, but it is similar in the terms of the treatment of the head of front office. It's the Denver Broncos. He said when he interviewed with the Denver Broncos, Elway and his main guy showed up late and hungover by his own just identity and what he could see with his eyes. Now, the third, the situation with Bill Belichick, the idea that he interviewed after they had decided who the candidate was, is the most interesting one, I think, because of how it affects Flores specifically. There's a couple other side issues. Boorish behavior from executives, competition elements, I think those are almost entirely separate matters from what Flores is really doing here, which is suing for his dignity. Basically, he's saying, you're not going to treat me like this without some level of restitution, whatever that may be. I think the court of public opinion has changed drastically in the last 5 to 10 years, if we're thinking about who's holding the seats, so to speak. Not that many people look at the NFL as de facto right in these situations as much as they did anymore. And I think that's going to weigh in a decision like Flores being able to do this. The second thing is this. The way that these two things affect each other is that you have to think to yourself, for the 31 men and one woman who own NFL teams, how much of this is really viewed as wrong in terms of their operational principle beyond just what the reaction from the public is? And that's where I think things get dicey when you talk about competitive balance and you talk about how people treat candidates, because there's no real way to change the humans not having a problem with being disrespectful to people. That's where this gets really murky. And so for Flores to say, you know what, how about we just make sure that you pay me for whatever the hell it is you chose to do? If you think it's wrong or you think it's right, that almost doesn't even matter. But if you can legally prove that you're on the hook for doing something that you're not supposed to do, I'll take that in my morality and move on with my life. I kind of think that's more where we are with Flores, and his timing is very effective to get to that result, right, even if it isn't winning over the largeness or turning over every mind of every NFL owner in history.
So the racism aspect of this is obviously the main part, and it's the most interesting, because if you look at, you know, the Giants part and them just sort of, you know, bringing him in after having already decided just so they can fit in the Rooney Rule, that is obvious and clear as day. You know, that is some form of, hey, just checking the box. We don't care. We're going to do it our way. The other stuff, you start to wonder, or if you just look at it on its own and say, hey, can you really prove any sort of racism there or any sort of racist issues there when you're talking about, you know, him, an owner asking his coach to tank. Now, philosophically speaking, as a strategy, like tanking is a strategy that some plenty of organizations over the years, mostly in the NBA, if you talk about it, sure. have implied, and it has worked out for some teams. And so I could totally understand, you know, some teams saying to themselves internally, hey, you know, it's best if we lose this stuff. Let's put, you know, maybe developmental players out there instead of our better players, et cetera, and hopefully we get that number one pick. But if you're Brian Flores, you can't actually take that directive from an owner because, like, that's when you start looking at the idea of take. It's like, wait a second. So now everybody has to be all in on this. And now all of my coaches who I hired, their reputations are going to be at stake. My reputation as a coach is going to be at stake. These players as well. So we're not going to do that. And you at the very top offering me that is not, you know, it's not great ownership. It's not great leadership. So you go on and then all of a sudden they're clashing now. And as he is doing a very good job, as a head coach, you talk with him talking about bringing in Tom Brady potentially and having to tamper in that case to get a quarterback that Stephen Ross wants, because that will forever change the Miami Dolphins organization. If you get Tom Brady on board, even for a couple of years, whether you win or not, you were the team that he went to after the New England Patriots. That's going to make you a huge deal. For Brian Flores, not really something he wants to do. For me to succeed, I've got to sell my soul with you, kind of cheat a little bit to get this guy. And what, re-implement everything that Bill Belichick did in New England, and now you're just bringing that to me? I don't want to do that.
Right.
That's not the quarterback that I want. And then after winning, you know, 10-6 with the, and then going, okay, hey, if you want a different quarterback, let's see how badly you want a different quarterback, because I think if Deshaun Watson's innocent, he should be a guy that comes over here. Let's see how far you want to go to get. And then all of a sudden it's painted as, oh, okay, well, now Brian Flores is pulling this quarterback situation apart, when in the beginning, you know, his owner wanted Tom Brady there and wanted him to tamper to get him there. So it's just like, and then after you get fired, surprisingly, after two seasons, and then they try to throw, and this is where the race element comes in. They try to say, hey, it was essentially an angry black man this whole entire time who did not get along with the people in the organization. And that is going to be probably impossible to prove, because you can run a smear campaign against anybody and say, oh, he was angry, he didn't get along with us. But you see the entire picture being painted, and you recognize that when you combine it with the fact that now after I've been smeared, I'm not going to get a realistic chance at another job. Instead, I'm just going to be strung along. That is just your pride and everything you realize that you've done, that you feel other people have felt, other candidates have felt over and over again. So you just get to the point, it's like, all right, I'm a leader of men. I'm going to go ahead and lead this group because we have been being tampered with. We have been being misled. We have not been treated properly. And it's just, when you look at it at the big picture, yeah, you can absolutely see the race elements involved there. I just don't know if you can prove it in a court of law.
June, do you think that he gets another job? How much do you think this affects his current search? Because this is pretty unprecedented as far as anything we've seen from a person at this level of personnel management in the NFL.
I'm pretty cynical about it because I look at what happened with Colin Kaepernick, and obviously it's a different situation, but it's the same group of NFL owners, and they're going to have the same opinion on it, on just generally how they handle race and the same attitudes and how they handle the race situation with Colin Kaepernick. And so I think that there's going to be a circus around this just from a media standpoint for a really, really long time until this lawsuit gets settled in one form or another. And I'm not sure that any owner, unless there is some massive ownership change, you know, sweep that happens across the sport and a general cultural mindset shift, that I can't be optimistic about that happening until there's a larger cultural shift that happens in the NFL. Because with the Rooney Rule, that's emblematic of a larger, deeper problem. The fact that that rule has to exist in order for teams to want to hire or even talk to minorities for positions of power in NFL organizations, that's indicative of a larger problem, because it's coming from a place of, we don't do this already. It's not built into our mindset and how we go about searching for coaches and general managers. We need to enforce this rule as a thing. And part of it is, there is a good intent behind having a rule like that, but most of the people who are running teams in the NFL don't care about that intent and are doing what they want to do and, you know, just wanting to check the box. And if that's not happening, you know, it's worthy of just kind of tearing down the rule in the first place and letting, you know, the attitudes of these owners and these power brokers be on full display without the facade of a Rooney Rule.
Well, to that point, let me ask you, Izzy, and I agree with you, is that the rule doesn't work because of the faith of the interloper, you know, the executors of said both sides. And so I guess what I'm asking you is what do you think is a win in this situation for any of the parties that are not the owners? I mean, okay, maybe he gets hired for this by the Saints. Is that a win for Flores? You know what I'm saying? Like, does that shut down any potential talk of the lawsuit? Where do you think that there's a victory for the so-called level of progress, whatever that may be?
Well, I mean, I don't think if he gets hired by the Saints that that's a victory necessarily, because it's one organization doing something correct, you know, by hiring, you know, the best candidate available, but it doesn't necessarily solve the issue. It doesn't prove that they're going to do right by him while he is in the organization. Mm. You know, so there's a lot, there's just a lot to unpack there. And you think, like, the only way to do this, like, this is basically the decision he made, and I mentioned earlier, like, this isn't Jemele Hill kind of made, right? When she sort of became, am I going to continue being the sports personality that I've wanted to be and that I've worked for my entire life, or am I going to shift my focus on sort of these racial injustices that's going on in the world? What's more important to me? And she made that intelligent, correct choice and, you know, sort of shifted her focus some. And I think, you know, this is something that Brian Flores probably is just taking responsibility for. Whether or not he gets another job, things have got to change everywhere. Ownership needs to change. You know, people of color need to be in ownership more commonly, so that the thoughts are going to change, as opposed to just, because you know how it works in this country, people hate when you tell them what to do. So if you tell them they have to do this, they're just going to do it and be like, ha ha, I got you. I don't actually have to do anything you're telling me to do. And so it actually has to be thoughts and people who think differently are involved in the process, not just, you know, checking a box that somebody else has required them to. So, I mean, there's just so much that has to be done, but this is where he's going with it. This is where, you know, in the thoughts and minds of every other, you know, front office that has to hire a coach in the future, it's like, wow, this isn't just about some rule that we had to fit. Like, this is, we're going to be checked in on every single element of what we're doing here. So let's maybe check in on ourselves and why we're even having these types of ideas, or why we're only interviewing, you know, one black candidate or anything like that. So the victory is a way much longer term situation, and it's got to really get into the, you know, the stitching of the NFL and the ownership groups. And just another coaching job isn't going to be enough.
And I think one of the major victories for Flores in this situation, to build off of Izzy's point, is that we are having this conversation right now, not just as a theoretical, like, is this an attitude that exists in the NFL? Is it something that has persisted over the course of a lot of time, that black head coaches and black general managers aren't getting hired? Like, there's receipts. We have text messages from Bill Belichick, who has a level of credibility in the NFL that is pretty much unparalleled because of his status as the greatest head coach of all time. And that is something that I think is pushing this into the forefront in a way where, you know, there's people who can look at this conversation, who have looked at this conversation in the past and been like, well, like, they chose the best candidate. This is a situation where, like, this kind of thing happening and this kind of mistake happening with Bill Belichick texting Brian Flores instead of Brian Daboll about the head coaching job for the Giants. Like, you can't deny that something has happened. The fact that Brian Flores even has to think about, you know, being in this position in the first place, that is an injustice within itself. The fact that he feels the need to be a symbol for all of this stuff that is happening and forcing a public conversation like this happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, we call it a problem. A lot of people say that there are solutions, but if the people that control the scenario don't actually think that there's anything wrong, well, then you got a problem. Alabaster, what's next?
I'll tell you something else real quick. I'll tell you something else that could sort of show some progress in this situation. If Stephen Ross decides, yeah, this has been an embarrassment for me, I'm going to go ahead and sell this team, because it has been nothing but embarrassment after embarrassment for him, who he decides to sell to, whoever is the next ownership group of the Miami Dolphins, that should be something that, you know, can help the situation. If there is a sort of black majority owner that can come out and that can buy this team, I think that would be, you know, a huge sign of progress in that scenario. But also enough to shake this man, Stephen Ross, to sell his team, when we know he wants all the shine. He wants Tom Brady. He wants tank for Joe Burrow or whoever it was. I guess it was Joe Burrow. He wants all this stuff, and he wants, you know, the ring at any cost. And now it's just going to be like, okay, this is the subject that was too much for me. I'm out of here. That's a powerful thing. And so I would say where Stephen Ross goes with this, I'd say, would be a symbol of, hey, are all the owners and all the NFL sort of digging in their heels and saying this is without merit, even without an investigation? Or are they shaking a little bit and saying, okay, this is serious. We actually have to address this ourselves.
And the public temperature on these issues is changing right now. The fact that Flores felt confident enough to put out a lawsuit like this, because this, he's not the only guy that has gone through this. And it's also not the only sport where this happens, where, you know, I've talked to people in the baseball world where they don't even take managerial job interviews because they don't want to be the guy fulfilling the C-League rule checkbox. Like, I think there is an attitude shift happening, maybe not amongst the, you know, the ruling power class of the billionaires that own football teams, but across a lot of America, where we're having these more difficult conversations in public places in a way that wasn't happening 10 years ago.
The children of the owners are listening, and they'll be the ones running the team soon. Moving right along. Alabaster, what do we got?
All right, we're moving on to another NFL story, and that is one that is going to be near and dear to DC native Clinton Yates. How do you feel about the Washington Commanders?
Let me tell you something, buddy. When I look out the window, I see Venice Beach, and I moved here a couple years ago, and half the reason I had no problem leaving my hometown is because this lame organization continues to waste everybody's time with lateral moves that will never matter to anything. Ever.
The Washington Commanders drove you out of the nation's capital.
What I'm saying is that a part of the reason a part of the reason why I was, this is a sort of a personal story, part of the reason why it was easy to leave is because, hello, you know what I'm saying? Like, none of these teams in that town are doing anything, and what they'd already done, I saw. And this is one of those examples. Bungled rollout on every single level. I don't even care what the name is or what the unis look like. You had a guy on a chopper with a telescope lens giving away your team name the night before you were supposed to go on the Today Show. Come on.
You just need a couple of curtains, you know, and maybe some black garbage bags to put, like, up on those
whatever
windows.
Whatever the name is, who cares? You're an irrelevant football team. But the rollout was, per usual, completely embarrassing for every single thing this team does, June. What do you think?
Like, I'm just fascinated by the fact that this is just emblematic of how this organization has been run for such a long time. Like, it's not that hard to keep this a secret. You keep it within a certain circle. You make sure that cameras aren't around when you're discussing the new logos. And we've seen, like, the prototype logos for a couple weeks now. The jerseys have been leaking on Twitter. Like, this is just emblematic of how dysfunctional this organization is, top to bottom. And for something as dumb and as like, you know, shallow as a team logo and a new name reveal.
Can we get the photo? I don't know if we can, actually, but if we can, the photo of the tank in the T-shirt, right? Because I'm pretty convinced it's a middle finger. It looks very much like a middle finger instead of a tank, which would be, you know, perfect for Snyder saying, you know, F all of you guys. What do you think about what Pat McAfee said? You know, the Commanders, short for, you know, the Commies, wearing red in our nation's capital.
I mean,
you think people are going to start calling them the Commies?
No, I think there's an old store that used to be really popular in D.C., actually in Georgetown. It's called Commander Salamander. I will be referring to them as the Salamanders from here on out, as far as I'm concerned. That's just what they are.
That's going to be a deep cut there. You're going to have to explain that every single time.
No, I'm not, because I'm never going to talk about them, because they're an irrelevant franchise. This is my whole point. This doesn't even matter. They suck, and only people talk about them when they do stupid S. This doesn't even, like, this to me, this is sort of totally inside baseball. I'm stunned this made the A's here, but they only made it because, hello, we saw an owner for the first time in the wild in like 3 years, man. This nobody's going to care about this in week four. Trust me.
I do wonder, though, given just Dan Snyder and his whole essence and aura, if people started calling the team the Commies, if he got angry, like, that would be like a fun...
That would,
like,
be funny.
Just little needle him, like, calling them the Commies, especially in D.C. Like, I think it could be a little fun.
That would be a Mr. Burns-level annoyance. That would be quite funny. I agree with that. But, like, what do you
guys... That's a funny little nugget there. Do you remember in 2013 when Dan Snyder told USA Today to put it in all caps that he would never change?
He said, you can print that.
The
and
defiance
now,
totally undercuts all caps. Yep. Totally undercuts all caps. Now all caps means nothing. I'm never going to use it in a text again.
Except unless it's on the front of your new jersey, because the team name now is in all caps on the front of the jersey.
The jerseys also look awful. Like, they look like the default create a jersey for when you're creating a franchise in Madden. Like, it's not... They're not good.
Right. It's embarrassing.
W looks like the waste management logo. It's all perfect.
Right. These are things. Perfect. Like, when I talk about football, I don't talk about that football team, because that football team is not good. That's pretty much what it comes down to. What's next?
All right.
I'm commanding this meeting. Thank you.
That's totally fair. You guys handled that topic the way it deserved by just crushing them and moving on. All right.
Just like on the football field.
We are moving on to basketball, and our topic is, what do you make of the latest details regarding the Ben Simmons and 76ers stalemate? This is reported by our friend, Ramona Shelbourne.
Momo's got a big deep dive on what's going on in the greater New Jersey, Philly suburbs area. There's some great breakdowns of the different towns where everything happens around the Sixers facility in this story. But the interesting part about the story is basically to me this. Elton Brand and Ben Simmons are not super tight, and Ben Simmons has problems making friends with people in a way that is not deeply personal. And that is just something that the Sixers don't do. The longer this goes on, the more I understand Ben Simmons' stance on this, which is, I never felt respected. It took some time to build respect. The burden is on you, in my opinion. The burden's on me, in your opinion. That's it, man. And like, when it comes down to how you run a team, this is a psychological shift that has happened to me specifically in the NBA. If you can't motivate your own players to get on the court, that's on you as a franchise. I really actually believe that in 2022, because there's so much that has changed from a power balance in terms of players and empowerment that, like, it only doesn't take a whole lot to get a guy on the court in terms of just being nice to him. You know what I'm saying? And if you can't not do that in order to possibly get a championship team together, to me, that means you're not running your organization correctly. I don't care how much money you're paying. I mean, that's on you.
Can we put the question back up real quick? Because I think the one syllable in this question that is the most important, or at least has the most meaning to me, is stale.
Yeah.
Because that's how this story has gotten. It has become so stale because people are tired of talking or listening to guys and girls talk. Guys and girls, wow. To men and women talk about Ben Simmons, who hasn't played a game yet and whose GM is being really stubborn and doesn't want to make a move, even though there have been a handful of offers and their asking price is way too large. Like, the only thing that was even, to me, like eyebrow-raising in this story, which was well done, was that he lost $19 million. And I'm like, that's a lot of money. But it's basically the equivalent of him taking a year off.
It's a year,
that's all that is. And so, like, you're either going to make a movie or not. Like, does Ben Simmons thinking that Joel Embiid talking, you know, poorly about him after the last playoffs was unfair because he didn't talk smack about Joel Embiid the playoffs before when they lost to Toronto? All that, you know, it's all interesting stuff. It's all stuff that we figure was probably deeper than that if this guy's willing to sit out the entire year. It's not just about, hey, my teammate talked about me after a playoff run. But I guess my whole thinking on this is just like, all right, I've heard enough. Like, I don't need to hear anymore. I just want to know when Daryl Morey is going to give and take in the right contract. Because if I'm a Philly player right now and we're going off and we're, you know, playing pretty well, let's say going off, and looking like they can maybe be a contender in, or a top four seed, et cetera, et cetera, I'm like, you know what? We got Tyrese Maxey, who's a really good player. If we had one more really good player, we would be contending in this Eastern Conference this year. So it's a stale situation right now. And the guy taking the brunt of it is Ben Simmons, whose reputation's being harmed. And, you know, his money's being taken from him. And, you know, he doesn't have a place to play. And it's like, just because, you know, Philly's being stubborn. And that's where I feel like this whole topic is. It's just kind of like stale.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what
this
else?
This is not an insult to producers, by the way. Not an insult to producers.
Like, what else are we supposed to say about Ben Simmons at this point? Because it's going to keep being this until, like, a trade happens. I think the point where I disagree with Clinton, though, is that the Sixers have been nice to Simmons, especially if you talk to people around that team. Like, there was almost a sense of them coddling Simmons for the last couple of years and not being critical enough, to the point where when they were critical of him, that's why he's reacted the way that he has. So I'm not sure. It might not necessarily be a sense of respect about them being nice to him. It's a sense of respect in that they felt that they had to be so nice to him because he couldn't take any criticism because of the way that he's, you know, been treated throughout the course of his career as the number one guy from, you know, Australia to LSU, to this point where, you know, he was so good that he wasn't able to take any criticism from anyone. And now the moment that he does get some criticism, he's not able to take it and is able, you know, shuts down and doesn't feel like he's being respected by the team.
But the criticism came from the team itself. That's my point. When your coach is on national television telling people that he doesn't think that you can be a championship point guard, that is more than just the average, here's a towel and here's a smoothie, you know, I don't know, Mark Cuban style from 15 years ago. I mean, I think that there is a fundamental fissure between these two sides that is reasonable to me. It just is at this point in terms of who players are. If you pick a guy who you know has this kind of mental makeup in terms of how you've got to deal with it and you F it up, that's on you. You know what I'm saying? Like, I still think there's a lot more responsibility. And I think this is a totally separate aside, but not really. I think this is going forward how a lot more teams are going to have to deal with players in the NBA. It's like, listen, man, if you can't get your guys on the court, then maybe you don't know what you're doing as an organization. The internal drive that is required from athletes, I think, is something that the responsibility is going to shift on and over the next 20 years, just because of the way that player empowerment works. And I think Ben Simmons is going to be looked at a little differently than he is now. It's just me. Yes, Alabaster.
Okay, so I want to get to the brass tacks of it all, because while you guys have focused on Simmons, and rightfully so, that was the crux of the question, I think the Embiid aspect is equally important in the fact that, like, we put down the stat that, you know, Simmons was upset with Embiid because he feels like he was the one who choked in the Toronto series a couple years ago. The stats don't back that up. Embiid has evolved into a completely different player since then. Someone who is one of the best seven-footers in the last decade, since Shaq, someone who's dominating, and his window is small. He's had back injuries, he's had knee injuries, he's had foot injuries. Do they have to trade Simmons in the next 8 days? Can they really hold this on and keep this going for years?
I've been on this, like, for a while. It bugs me that Daryl Morey says this could go on for 4 years, because, again, you're keeping your team, holding your team hostage. And part of the reason why Joel Embiid has become this player is because he has the space on the floor with which to operate. And so this idea, and, you know, the ball in his hands, this idea that you must have this other, this James Harden type, I do think that Joel Embiid will be good for James Harden. I do not think that James Harden will necessarily be good for Joel Embiid, at least not this Joel Embiid that we've seen, which is why I'm saying get yourself somebody who's less ball dominant, somebody who won't cost you nearly as much. And there's probably going to be a technical difficulties thing on my box pretty soon, because I see some around the horn stuff on my screen.
All right, well, June, what do you got? Because I think that you got to trade him for basketball reasons. And I think that at this point, because of what Izzy talked about, this stalemate, the only reason to do anything is a basketball reason, because the emotional reasons are not going to be overcome anytime soon, if ever.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before with you guys on the show, where the window for Embiid is so small, and I think it's imperative, especially with, you know, big men, your knees go out and it's over the next day. Like, it could end in a snap. It could end really, really quickly. But I do think an interesting contrast point between Embiid and Simmons is that Embiid received a lot of criticism from guys like Shaq and Barkley about the way that he played inside as a big man. And he has improved in so many ways since then. He has taken criticism well and improved. And I think that's a very interesting contrast point to the way that Ben Simmons has handled this entire situation. Because, you know, we've been talking about Simmons' jump shot for years, almost his entire career. It's always been Simmons is going to be a top five player if/when he develops that jump shot, and he has never taken the initiative to even put himself out there to potentially fail in the eyes of the public at getting better at that. And I think that is a major contrast point between why Embiid has been able to take his game to the next level and why Simmons is sitting at home right now.
Yeah, that's true. Izzy, do you think, when's the next time you think we see, and this is just a ballpark, give me a month and a year,
the next time we see Simmons on the floor?
Yeah,
I mean, unless some team really, because you got to think about it, the team that's going to sort of ramp up the interest right around trade deadline or these next week or so is a team that feels like, not that they want him, but that they need him.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to give more at the trade deadline just because you like the guy. It's terrible business. And so I just don't know if I see the team that's telling themselves, hey, we win a championship if we get Ben Simmons this year. And I don't think Daryl Morey is the type that's just going to give and take a package, you know, that includes Jeremy Grant or something like that. So, yeah, I think it's probably October 2022.
Wow. June?
I feel like we've just been circling a wheel every single week, being like, is this the team that could, you know, trade for Ben Simmons? Is it going to be Bradley Beal and the Wizards? Is it going to be the Kings this week? Like, I want to see this guy on the floor. Like, when he's on, like, it's very, very fun to watch Ben Simmons play. I hope he develops a jump shot, but I don't think we're seeing him until next season.
I think it'll be a trade deadline next season when we see this guy play for another team. That's what I think. What's next?
All right, we are moving on to a game of Who Done It.
Who Done It?
This is the game where we give you a quote. You guys come together and tell us who done it.
Okay, so we have a new, silhouette. We've gone through a couple on this particular iteration. We've had the Island Boys. We've had them. We've had whoever that dude in the fedora is. What's your guess on this?
This is a football coach, right?
No, or is it Steve Nash?
It's Steve Nash. It's Steve Nash.
It's Steve Nash.
That's right.
He is the king of whodunits. Yes. All right.
Like he's got this confident.
Well,
you know, power post silhouette.
I feel like this is an older Steve Nash. Like, when is this? What is this actual picture? Is this him coaching or is this him just standing? Oh, OJ took a spill. It's him. Hold on.
I was going to say, you guys, is a little earthquake over there? You're,
OJ's taking
your
a spill on Clinton's couch every single week.
I mean, it's a feature. It's a feature, not a bug of the program. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, what's the first one?
All right. First one.
Steve Nash.
You get in the playoffs and it's 0-0. And your choices are Russell Westbrook, Joel Embiid, Tyler Hero, or Steve Nash.
I think it's Steve Nash.
I think it's Steve Nash.
I think Charlie's trolling us.
That's not even a troll. That's a good bit at that point because he did the silhouette, making us think there's no way he's doubling down with Steve Nash. And
plus,
also,
the Nets have been
Russell Westbrook's
too.
Right, this makes sense within the Steve Nash universe, the Steve Nash cinematic.
If Tyler Hero said it, I would know. I get all alerts every time.
What do we got? Oh wait,
I mean,
we have
always in reach when you get to the playoffs.
Oh no!
It went with the too easy.
Alabaster, you dog! You had us all set up for the bit, and then you threw the back.
You had too much faith in Charlie Clinton.
To Russell, I know. I also.
I gotta tell you.
Are the Lakers getting in the playoffs? Izzy, your thoughts?
Well, I was just gonna say I did the Lakers Hornets game last Friday in Charlotte, and that was without LeBron or Anthony Davis, and that's where Russell Westbrook scored 30 in the second half, the most since Kobe's last game for any Laker in a half. And damn it, if I didn't want them to win the game so badly. Like, I never wanted to talk to Russell Westbrook more. Frankly, I very rarely want to talk to Russell Westbrook. I'm always afraid he's just going to give me short answers. But I never wanted to talk to him more. Would have been a great story. And I love the Hornets. Like, that's all I talked about during the broadcast, and I love talking to Miles Bridges. But, man, that was one of the times in my life where I was just cheering for a shot to go in really hard when he took a pull-up three down two with, like, 17 seconds left. I was like, come on! And it didn't go. And, like, I think Miles Bridges could see the disappointment in my face, unfortunately, when I was interviewing him.
I was also watching that game, and I expected it to play out exactly the way that it did because Russell Westbrook as a number one on a team at this point is like, you can't have that happen in today's NBA.
You guys should see the mental gymnastics that the local dudes out here go through trying to talk about this team and stay positive remotely.
Give us a taste.
Well, this is part of it. I mean, the idea is that, well, if they make the playoffs, people come back healthy, they can put things together, yada, yada, LeBron will take over, that's why he's resting. It's just, it's not realistic.
They're definitely a playoff team with Anthony Davis. With Anthony Davis, they're definitely a playoff team. They're going to be a tough out whichever round. But I don't see anything that tells me they can hang with the best of the best.
You mean like they make the play-in tournament?
No, I think with Anthony Davis, they are, you know, I don't know if they reach it, but they are effectively a top six.
Okay, like realistically from right now, not like in the overall machinations of what could have been. Like, where do you think this team gets to right now? June, you go first.
Well, I just don't think that, like, the problems with the Lakers isn't even about it is about the top of the roster, but it's also, they have no depth. Like, they're relying way too much on Talen Horton-Tucker. Like, Austin Reeves is getting so many minutes. Like, Avery Bradley isn't the, like, top-tier perimeter defender that he was, like, 5 years ago. Like, it's not just about the fact that Russell Westbrook is old. Like, the entire roster is old. And, like, LeBron was pushing back about that at in the offseason when we looked at the average age of the roster and it was, like, 33 or whatever it was. Like,
experience.
This roster is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah.
Okay, no, I do not think they're going to make it to the top six. I don't think they're catching Denver. They are currently four and a half games back. So they'll definitely be a play-in team. Hang on, standings right here.
I think he's checking the standings because he's not familiar with how far back they actually are. Right. At this
definitely
moment.
Be a play-in team, but if they are a play-in team and let's say play Portland, I'm giving them that win. Okay. And they will be, you know, the seventh seed going into a series against Golden State, which is what the NBA wanted last year. They might end up getting it this year. So that I can see as a strong possibility. And hey, what can beat the Warriors? Some talented size. And, you know, Anthony Davis at the five and LeBron at the four. Maybe. So there you go. I've already created a perfect storyline for the NBA playoffs.
This is
Lakers-Warriors in the first round.
This is like borderline delusional optimism about the Lakers.
Borderline, completely. What's next?
No. A seven seed? Not exactly delusional confidence there for a
Them
no,
beating
anybody Lakers fans
at anything is
trying
delusional.
Trying to imagine a scenario where they keep up with the Warriors who have so much more depth than them makes no sense.
All I gave them was one win against the Portland Trailblazers and the possibility of making life difficult on the Warriors.
Making
That's all I did.
Difficult.
All right, that is not delusional confidence.
The idea of them making life difficult for the Warriors is delusional.
That's not That's not real. What's
you guys
next?
Remember the Austin this Reeves? Is... You guys remember the Austin Reeves video with LeBron telling him and
yes.
him just looking super confused?
That's what just
I
happened.
Talked to Austin Reeves about yes. that. It really wasn't that interesting. It was just an after timeout play, and he wasn't paying attention. And then LeBron was telling him where to go, and he was just like, wow, that's not at all what I thought I was going to do. And then that was it.
Alas.
Yeah. He thought he was just supposed to stand in the corner, and LeBron was like, nope, you got to follow me here. You got to do this and that. And he's like, well, damn it. I didn't know that that was it.
Right. Steve Nash,
there you go.
What's next?
Now he's famous.
All right. Next we got, at this point, you can't touch nobody defensively, or it'll be two free throws. And your choices
Steve
are
Nash.
Marcus Smart, Patrick Beverley, James Harden, or Steve Nash?
I'm gonna take a guess here and assume that this is Patrick Beverley, because Patrick Beverley, as much as his game has sort of, we'll just say, evolved in the last 3 years, loves touching people. Patrick Beverley is the guy
Crazy.
That will, like, hold your hand afterwards just to kind of annoy you. He did that to LeBron the other day where he just held his hand after a foul and, like, walked 4 or 5 steps with him. Patrick Beverley loves touching human beings. So I'm going to guess this is Patrick Beverley.
It's not C or D, right? Because they've always been complaining that James isn't getting enough free throws. So now all of a sudden they're not flipping the switch there. It's either A or B. I don't know. I'm going to go with Marcus Smart. I'm going to say it's a little different.
I think I'm with Clinton on this. Okay. Although I probably would have phrased it differently.
At this point, you can't touch nobody. Why? Physically,
look at these upsets.
Or they shooting 2 free throws.
Wow.
What is happening?
We are over.
Did he not check the tapes?
What?
Did he not recognize that he complained about the exact opposite for the first half of the season? What's going on?
That's amazing to me. Harden is averaging 8.7 free throw attempts per game for his career, most among active players, yet he is still complaining about people getting... Wow. Wow. What's going on here?
That's like Duncan Robinson complaining about getting foul calls against him. It's like, you're not a great defender. Go ahead. Like, take the foul.
This was an upset.
The replay, don't lie.
This was an upset, I must admit, June.
Yeah, I did not expect that.
The greatest upset would be Steve Nash, of course.
I feel
gaslit
by Charlie right now.
I know, right? I don't really know what to think. I'm feeling real Flores-like about my standing in this interview situation. I don't really know where I stand or what I'm here for. I'm joking. Let's go.
All right, guys, we got one more.
All right.
If this isn't Steve Nash, I'm blowing up this show.
To me, there's no moral victories, but we're moving in the right direction. I'm proud of the effort. And your choices are Ty Lue, Alvin Gentry, Frank Vogel, or Steve Nash.
Steve Nash.
Is this Steve Nash?
Steve Nash.
Let us celebrate.
Steve Nash.
Yeah!
We're moving in the right direction, and we get some health. You know, we'll be able to play teams like this. So, I'm proud of the effort. I think they're doing what we're asking for. Now we're just pushing them to have longer stretches of high intensity concentration and take another step.
He's got to have the best hair of any coach in the league, right?
James Harden had a terrible game, by the way. He shouldn't be complaining about the officials.
Sidebar.
Steve Nash is the primary reason why I am upset that coaches don't have to wear suits anymore, because that dude would absolutely kill it on the sidelines if he could let his fashion chops, you know, show. And
really?
I think for the playoffs, I'm going to make a little preview, spoilers. I'm going to definitely push right before the playoffs for the NBA to have their coaches dress in suits again first for the postseason.
Really?
You think I'm going to have any influence whatsoever?
I kind of like that. You know, I'll join your coalition. We can do this. I kind of like that.
Okay.
Like, hey, regular season, you can get away with the half zips and the sweatsuits. But listen, when it comes to the tournament, we're getting down to business. I like this, Izzy. Right. You have convinced me.
Clinton's in on the class action suit. What about you, Jim?
We would not have so many, like, iconic Pat Riley suit moments if he was forced to wear a quarter zip. Like, I am pro suit, especially when it meets the moment.
There
we go.
That's a great idea. Wow. You could have, like a playoff line. What's up?
So, before we move on, I need to bring it back to basketball for 1 second. Can we talk about the Suns here? They're 41-9 and have won 11 straight games.
Yeah.
This is our Western Conference representative. This is sort of what we thought the Warriors were early in the season. This is the dominant team, and I feel like they get no love.
No, they get plenty of love. I just think that what you brought up is a realistic element in terms of the chronology of the timelines of NBA fans. Klay Thompson came back, Playboy. The Warriors look like the team that changed all of our lives. The Suns were absolutely going to get forgotten in that equation, and I don't think the Suns mind that. You know what I'm saying? People forgot about the Suns last year. They eliminated the Lakers, kind of laid an egg in the later series in the finals. I mean, this makes sense to me that people have forgotten about the Suns because nobody really remembered who the Suns were when they were making their run, and everybody remembers the Warriors. I'm not that upset about this. I don't think they're getting disrespected. I think this is normal, Izzy.
I think the Suns have a little bit of the Mike Trout syndrome where they're just like consistently excellent to the point where like people forget about them. Like there's no drama with this team. Like they're really, really good.
It just not with the team. The owner.
I have not forgotten about them. Yes. In fact, there's one memory that is burning in my mind about the Phoenix Suns. And it comes from January 8th when they lost to the Miami Heat 123-100 in Phoenix without, I believe Jimmy Butler was not in that game. And that's the last game they lost. And that's the last thing I remember about the Phoenix Suns. So
I'm so mad.
Not going to really talk about it. We can talk about the Miami Heat if you want.
I'm so mad that that
actually
Yeah, I was right. No Bam, no Bam and no Jimmy.
Damn it, I can't
no Bam and no Jimmy.
I cannot believe that actually lined up.
You guys set me up for that one. I mean, look at the schedule. That's their last loss,
Charlie,
and it was a terrible loss, and it was Jimmy, no Bam.
Be honest, Krabs. Did you know that?
No, I didn't, because I just don't view the Heat as a relevant team in my life.
Heat so Suns in the finals? That's Heat in five. Heat Suns in the finals is Heat in five. Tyler Hero takes over Devin Booker.
We could be talking about potatoes, and Izzy would find a way to bring it back to Heat culture.
If that potato was being lauded as the best team in the NBA after losing to another team without its stars by 23 points, okay? If that potato was what we were talking about, then yes, it would be reeled back in to Heat culture talk.
Are you done yet? Is the Heat culture?
I mean, I was just making a perfectly normal note, one that was relevant to our conversation.
What does Heat culture think about Stephen Ross? How about that, Playboy?
Oh, that's a totally different sport. They are not intertwined.
I'm sorry. So they're just different. Miami, nothing? Okay. All right. Just making sure.
Nope.
The most unfair thing before we move on is just the fact that you know, there are some great, great Heat culture Twitter follows like our own Ryan Cortez. But for the most part, the Heat culture talk, you're making me not want to watch one of the most fun teams in the league to watch. It's really unfair. Hmm.
Did you see?
I mean, if you would have watched the game in Phoenix, you'd be talking about it just like me. That was a great game. And it tells you all you need to know about Heat culture.
They wore They wore those goofy, like, serial killer unis the other day.
ransom note
that's what I'm getting at. And Guy, you know, he's got the crazy long hair, and I was just like, if my dad had looked at the NBA like 20 years ago and been like, that guy is standing at the free throw with that hair and that uniform and that whole setup. I love Gal Guy, by the way. But it was just
Miami Heat's a great Twitter follow, too. Right? When they had him for the first game, they just took a picture of him close up on the sidelines, and the caption was, "What's poppin'?"
He's got a
Because he looks exactly like Jack Harlow.
He's got a great look going right now. So, Guy, keep it up. Virginia Cavalier. What's next?
All right, we're moving on to What Are the Chances? It's a game where we'll give you a topic, sometimes with a video. You tell us the chances. First topic.
Is the first one, what are the chances that Clinton makes it to the Around the Horn set on time?
You know, I don't appreciate this. My blood pressure's going up. Tony, if you're
They'll
watching.
They'll wait for you.
So confused how you plan this out, man. I'm already at the studio.
It's called Uber. I'll be there. It'll be fine. I'll live tweet it so that you guys on Twitter can find out about how this goes. It's just going to be me sitting on the 405. That's what it's going to be. What are the chances? What's we got?
All right, first topic. What are the chances the Lakers and Jerry West will ever make up?
Oh, to quote an individual whose jersey is hanging in the rafters, who's not named Jerry West, they are never, ever, ever getting back together. Okay. Taylor Swift is in the crypto.com center. It's hung up in the rafters if you didn't know that. So 0% or nil. You can write NIL so we can have some people can get confused who are just watching. There you go.
Name, image, and likeness.
See? See what I did there?
I feel like it's one of those things where it's like when Jerry West is in bad health near the end of his life, like that's when we'll start to see the makeup happen.
Wow, that was cryptic. Okay.
I'm just being real.
Where would the Lakers be post Jerry Buss if not for LeBron wanting to be in LA? Where would they be? This organization would be something of a disaster.
That's something right? of. Yeah, it would be a complete disaster.
And so, you know, the Jerry West just falls in line, like them, that relationship being ruined just falls in line with a group that doesn't seem to be running an organization particularly well and just got salvaged by, you know, LeBron in a bubble. So,
I'm going to say 0%
that I have to say, though, why is Jerry West still hanging around? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you went to two different teams, one in town, the other in California. Like, why are you even, you know what I'm
competition-aholic.
Saying?
Competition-aholic. Pat Riley's still doing
it. I guess that's true.
You know, he just happened to be with one organization the whole time.
But that's kind of my point. I don't think that if Pat Riley walked into Madison Square Garden and they were like, Pat, get the hell out of here, he'd be like, don't you know who I am? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, this seems like a little late stage to be arguing over things like season tickets for Jerry West, the logo. I don't know. I just feel like this is beyond both of these sides at this point. Why would you? I don't know. This is weird to me.
I also wonder if the Bus family, like, they like feel guilt every time they look at the NBA logo because they're reminded of like this petty thing that's happening between the two sides.
It's weird.
June, before you give your percentage, could you just make sure it has a 9 in it?
9.1%.
There you go.
What?
Let's all watch Charlie write a 9.
You love
this. I hate
this.
You guys. I hate you guys.
You love this. It's the underneath style. It's the Oh, he went back.
Oh, he changed it up. Wow.
Wow.
Look at that. He's been practicing and everything.
I can't
Good
believe
job.
This show is an inside joke about handwriting. Steve Nash and handwriting jokes. What's next?
With all this technology we got and all these little things we got going across the bottom of the screen, they chose Sharpie. So they get what they
get. I hope Charlie is like secretly taking calligraphy classes on the side.
I think I told you guys this, but I almost didn't get into kindergarten, or was almost held back in kindergarten because my handwriting was so bad.
I'm ordering my Uber right now, just so you guys know.
All right, last topic.
So I can make sure
we got a video clip for this one.
Okay,
and this one starts the context here. We have a 13-year-old pitcher pitching to Joey Bautista in a game of blitzball.
Joey Bass!
That pitcher's name is Doodoo Biscuit. And our question is, what are the chances that Doodoo Biscuit is going to the show?
Doodoo Biscuit?
Oh, my God.
Woo!
Woo! This is...
That does not make me want to eat breakfast, but that is very, very impressive. Doo-doo biscuit.
No, this is the only thing that matters here. How did you come across this footage?
Twitter?
You, Charlie, where did you find this? Like, where, what person sent this to you that said, doo-doo biscuit, bro, this has to make the show? Blitzball, Joey Bats that nobody can recognize, even though he follows everybody on Twitter on Earth. Like, there's a million videos like this one that follow my IG every single day of the week. I'm wondering who sent this to you, Charlie, in your baseball life.
No, for real, I actually just stumbled upon this on Twitter on Monday, and I held it for 2 days because you two, or I'm excluding you, Izzy, from this, are the only two people I know who care about baseball. And they want to talk about Doodoo Biscuit.
So that's the truth comes out. All right.
I've actually seen enough videos of people pitching wiffle to think that that would make a pretty dope sport to watch on TV. Like, there was a dude, there's videos of dudes getting struck out because the pitcher's hitting the bat that's on his shoulder, sort of sweeping around, hitting a bat. That's a foul. That's a strike. You know what I'm saying? Right. And so this stuff is quite wildly entertaining. And, like, obviously Joey Bats didn't put a bat
I have a proposal. Because it seems like more and more baseball season is not going to start on time right now. We just start a rogue blitzball league with all these baseball players, and we air it on social media. Like,
people would watch that.
Like, I would watch Lucas Giolito throw a blitz ball and see the way that he can make it curve and dive and, you know, throw 90 miles per hour.
I'm going to say
see
one...
the way that ulnar collateral ligament tears. I'll pay for that.
I'm going to say 1% because I would watch this event exactly one time. That's what I'm going to say.
I'm going to say he's going to a show. So I'm going to go 9%.
Panic at the Disco?
He's gonna be featured on a blitzball YouTube channel.
Try to sneak that 9 in there.
blitzball YouTube channel?
Yeah, he'll be featured on YouTube. He'll have a YouTube presence. I say 0%.
Okay. Doodoo Biscuit.
To be fair, Doodoo Biscuit had some nice mechanics.
No, he didn't. He wasn't even that good at it. I've seen way better blitzball throwers in my life. He's okay, but he's a movement guy. He's not a location
Clinton
guy.
Yates blitzball connoisseur.
Not connoisseur.
Guys,
I watched too much of this stuff, June. I said one time.
When you
like,
hear
I'm not
the
lying.
Sentence. Sorry.
Go ahead.
When you hear the sentence that I now play pickleball, your first thoughts are what?
Are you good
Does
enough
that make
to
make me old?
No.
Does it make me old?
Let me tell you something, buddy. The pickleball courts down at Venice are the most interesting part of the whole setup.
What is
that's where
pickleball?
All the cool people. That's where all the cool people are and all the fun athletes. Oh yeah.
It's like a weird combination of tennis, ping pong, and badminton.
It's like playing ping pong.
It's like mini tennis, but with a wiffle ball.
It's like playing ping pong on top of a tennis court. Like the way I'm going to say something terrible. I'll tell you later, but never mind. Yeah. Anyway, it's a fun sport that involves a heavier ball and a heavier racket than tennis that you only hit in the short court is what it comes down to.
Okay.
All right, guys. Yes. Well, that's a show. And on our way out, I'm going to leave you with this tweet from Long Live the Queen, who tweeted this image of the Heat's championship trophy ceremony for beating the Suns by 23.
Hey, it was a big day. It was a big day.
That's funny. That is funny.
They, by the way, have been on top of the Eastern Conference a lot like the Phoenix Suns. I don't think they are currently, but they have been. So if we're saying why don't we talk about the Suns enough, why don't we talk about the Heat some more?
Oh, my God. If you want to know, June will be on Around the Horn. I'll be on Around the Horn. But I have to put on clothes and dash downtown in the next hour. We'll see if we can do it. You can follow
me. Probably not talking about P.J. Tucker
on
Around the Horn, are you?
But
you should be. The guy's the no-stats all-star over there.
Goodbye.
Carrying
we'll see you next week talking on a Wednesday about the number 9 and whatever else is going on in the world of Doo-Doo Biscuit. Thank you, Charlie.
#HeatCulture. Ha ha.